right. So welcome to our very first podcast from VSU. We are the Undergraduate Research Council, and we have decided to begin these so that students can get to know their professors better and maybe get some information on how to work on their research. So our first guest is Dr. Fred Knowles. He has his PhD from the University of Missouri-Columbia and his JD from Mitchell-Hamlin. He's published a great deal in several areas, including Native American education, Native American sobriety. He's also published several articles in criminal justice and sociology that hopefully he'll tell us more about. Right now, he is a professor in criminal justice, sociology, anthropology here at VSU. And he is head of the Native American and Indigenous Studies Program. So welcome, Dr. Knowles.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you here. What we're going to do is start out with a few questions and feel free to elaborate however you feel is important for the students to let them know what you do and what you want to be involved in. And our first question is, what research areas have you worked in?
Over my 25 or 30 years, whatever it's been, since I've been in academia, I've been involved in a whole lot of different research areas. I guess a good place to start would be with my dissertation. And what I did there was try to bring up classic sociological theory and apply it to the problems of Native American education. And then I moved forward into critical theory with Habermas. It took some of the solutions from Habermas and Habermasian theory and applied it to the problems that had been created by the colonialism of Indian education. So that was my dissertation. And for the purposes of full disclosure, I think you and I co-wrote an article that stemmed from that very same philosophical position. I think, let's see, what did I do then? I probably moved right into the law. I've written a whole lot and researched a whole lot on federal Indian law, on the body of law between the federal government and the sovereign Indian nations of the United States. There is not really a body of state Indian law because the state, any given state, is not on the equal footing with the sovereign Indian nations. That is to say that, you know, any treaties that exist between Native American nations and the federal government must exist with the federal government because they're treaties. So they're handled like a foreign nation, if you will, like a treaty between the U.S. and Canada. Subsequently, there can't be any real close interaction treaty-wise between the state and federal. So I focused a whole lot in federal Indian law and interpreting treaties and the like, and that led me into joining the tribal bar at Pascua-Yaqui out in Tucson, Arizona, and then led me into a further study of law and pursuing my Juris Doctorate up at Mitchell-Hamlin in St. Paul. The scope of my research is very broad. I mean, I've researched and published in the areas of mass casualty, mass murders as an offshoot of my criminology background, and I've published in the area of confrontation clause of the Constitution in the area of my legal background, and I've published in the area of general pedagogy and post-colonization pedagogy and the like. So my research palette is very broad, I'm afraid.
I think that's wonderful. I don't think there's anything wrong with having a wide research background.
Well, I don't know. I've had other people say that if I stayed more narrowly focused, that I could go far deeper given my time as opposed to hitting on a lot of topics, but I guess there's two approaches. You could do it one way or the other.
Absolutely. Absolutely. My next question is, given your various projects that you've done, was there a favorite project or a least favorite project that you're willing to share with us?
Well, I don't have any least favorite. I've had some most frustrating projects, but no least favorites because, you know, as an academic, as a professor or someone who is publishing in the world, in the academic world, you can pretty much choose your own topic. So you don't pick one that you're going to dislike. You try to stay with something that is of interest and furthermore, something you can contribute to the overall knowledge. So there's nothing that I've been involved in that I've really disliked. There's some pieces of research I've been involved in that I've been more and more frustrated with because where you start is not where you finish. Your immediate vision is not where you're going to wind up. So, but that's true with anybody's research agenda, I think. It's not just mine. The research that I've liked the most has been that that's brought the most positive outcome, like an article that a colleague and I published a few years ago on the changes to federal law concerning the Confrontation Clause of the Constitution. And I had many practitioners tell me that was useful. And that article that I talked about a moment ago, actually it's a book chapter, on mass casualties, while that sounds far afield from the rest of my research, I've actually been cited a good deal in that. And I was cited a good deal in the Habermas work that I did. So you can, you know, that's how you know that you're making an impact on your disciplines. And that's what's been most rewarding, is the ability to help somebody else open doors and go through doors that I have not even found yet. That's probably the most rewarding thing. So research is at once very frustrating and also very rewarding. It's going to be that way.
I understand you wrote a book on Thurgood Marshall as well that's been extremely well received by law schools and graduate programs alike.
Yeah, I'm happy to say that that particular work was well received. Thurgood Marshall has always been one of my legal heroes. For the listener who is not absolutely familiar with him, he is the first African-American Associate Justice on the Supreme Court. And he has a fascinating career to follow, starting as the chief legal advocate for the NAACP in the years of the Jim Crow problem that we had in America. So just a fascinating man, a fascinating legal career. And I got to thinking about him one day as I'm thinking about federal Indian law, and I'm wondering, once he got on the Supreme Court, of all the federal Indian law sorts of cases that he heard or wrote an opinion on, where would he fall? Because, you know, he was a pioneer for civil rights. I mean, a lot of people don't realize he is the guy who argued before the Supreme Court on behalf of the NAACP and the plaintiffs in Brown versus Board of Education, which desegregated schools. Public schools were desegregated because of that particular case. And subsequently, like dominoes, the rest of society followed. The impact of Thurgood Marshall cannot even begin to be measured in terms of civil rights. So knowing he was this bastion of civil rights, I was really curious then to wonder where he would fall on Indian rights as a subset of civil rights. So what I did is I took all the years he was on the Supreme Court as an Associate Justice, and I looked at all the cases that he heard that were involved with Indian law at all, and I came up with 23 of them. And I found that on 22 of those cases in which he wrote an opinion, and he was a prolific writer. He wrote some in support of the majority and some in dissent, but on 22 of those cases, of the 23 that he wrote an opinion, the opinion was vehemently and vociferously pro-Indian. I mean, he was exceptionally pro-Indian, and that then begs the question about that 23rd case. And that 23rd case is known as Mitchell versus U.S. It's Mitchell 1 to the legal scholars, and it is the first iteration of Mitchell versus U.S. And in that case, the Indian position did not fare well, and Thurgood Marshall wrote the majority opinion turning down the Indian position, but he kind of framed the argument for the Indian plaintiffs, which essentially, to the astute reader, would tell the reader, go back and reframe your argument in this manner and reapproach us again, and you'll probably get a different outcome. That's precisely what Mitchell did, is went back and reframed the argument using a different body of federal law and brought the case again to the Supreme Court and was successful. And Thurgood Marshall wrote the opinion in that as well. So that one decision that he wrote on, in which he didn't support the Indian position, he basically gave a roadmap to the plaintiffs about how to restructure the case and bring it back and be successful. So that research was fascinating to me. I got a chance to really dig in deep in a very isolated part of one of my legal heroes. It came out better than I thought it would in terms of his positioning on Indian law. And it generated not a lengthy book, but I think a fairly comprehensive book. And as you mentioned, Dr. Levin, it's been cited a good number of times. And that is really rewarding for the scholar to have their work picked up and used by someone else.
It is wonderful when that happens. And it's a well-deserved recognition because it's just a fascinating book. One of the things that occurs to me and I'm really curious about is when you take on something like the Thurgood Marshall case, how do you go about your research? For instance, like I research everything I can find. I try and find all aspects. And then when I sit down to write, I will write for hours and hours and hours on end. Other people go and research in a very specific fashion and then maybe write 4 hours a day or 2 hours a day. What's your process?
Well, using the Thurgood Marshall Project as an example, because that brought in two or three different kinds of research. I did some historical research on him first. I read all the credible biographical information I could find on him, and I knew a lot of it already, having been a fan of his. But I wanted to really get inside Justice Marshall's head and understand what he was saying when he said this or wrote that. I wanted the background. So I went back and refreshed the biography of Thurgood Marshall, did a lot of reading in that area. That was even before I opened up the first piece of case law. And then after I got that nailed down, and along the way, I took, you know, cursory notes, things I wanted to refer back to, either thoughts or quotes or something like that, explanations. So I kept a notebook on that. And then I turned to the federal Indian law and started looking at the case law, every case that he wrote an opinion on, either in agreement or dissent, while he was on the Supreme Court. And as I said, I found 23. There were 23. And then I just took those cases and read the published opinions. Now, some people don't realize this about the Supreme Court, but when the Supreme Court publishes an opinion, when they decide a case, they will publish an opinion. It's necessary. It's required by law. They have to write an opinion. So one of the justices will write an opinion, and then other justices who agree with that justice's majority opinion will perhaps write opinions to support it, but then dissenting opinions will also be published with the majority opinion. And we all know that we lost Justice Ginsburg just a while back. She was a wonderful dissenter. Her dissenting opinions are just amazing to read. What you do is you just read the case law, you read the story, you read what the justice writes in terms of how did they come to the decision that the majority did, and then you read the dissenting opinions. You learn a lot more about federal Indian law sometime from the dissents than you do from the majority. So the second phase was going back and rereading all of those, well, finding that there were about 24 cases, and then going back and rereading all those 24 cases. And the source material is not hard to find. Now you can find it on the internet. It's quite easy to find. So then I read the cases and I kept notes on that. And then I tried to figure out how am I going to arrange this manuscript. And I thought I would do it chronologically. That made the most sense. So after an introduction in this book explaining what I was doing and what I intended to do, I just went through with the earliest case on through to the latest case. And basically, you know, summarized and sometimes quoted the decisions of Marshall with these cases. Now, frequently I had to give the background factual information for the case because it's not going to be evident necessarily from his dissents especially. So, you know, I'd fill in all the blanks and then kind of express the importance of his dissent or his majority opinion just to let the reader get an idea, a common thread of his way of thinking chronologically as we go through the cases. And then I thought it would be good for the reader, because we're talking about 24 cases and law is alien to a lot of people, it would be kind of cool to have a couple of tables thrown in to show which cases he agreed with, which he published dissent in, things like that. And then, in terms of the actual writing of it, after all those notebooks are filled up, then I just sit down and I am one to kind of binge write. I don't do a bunch of drafts. I write a paper mostly in my head before I sit down at the computer to write. And that works well for me. It doesn't work well for everybody, but it works well for me.
That's wonderful. I myself am one of those that has to do 4 dozen drafts before I can say, well, I'm pretty pleased with this. So I always admire people who can figure it out in their head and write it and not have to do so many drafts. I mean, I know you do some drafts too, but it's just a different style. So that's really interesting. I'm curious, would you be willing to share with us one of the biggest obstacles you've had in your research and your strategy for overcoming that, if you can think of one right off the spot here?
Yeah, I can think of one. Working in the world of Native America and in Indian country, and one of the problems that, and Dr. Lubber, you can attest to this as well, one of the problems that you have as a Native American intellectual, and I hate to use that term, but we all know what that means, basically, a person of letters. One of the problems that you have as a Native American intellectual is that too frequently publishing houses dismiss you because you will not just go along with the colonized European way of thinking. So you have to find the right publishing house. That was one obstacle to overcome. And then it's important that you surround yourself with maybe mentors, intellectual mentors in the field. You know, I have a number of people who started off as mentors for me and now are close friends of mine that we share common interest in federal Indian law and in Indian federal policy and, you know, things of that nature, treaty law and international indigenous rights, things like that. And I had some excellent professors in law school, and I continued to communicate with them. Having a pack of mentors who are more experienced in the area than you really does help. But the biggest obstacle I've had in my field is getting people to give any credibility at all to the Indian perspective. And that's true whether I've written about Indian pedagogy or the Indian perspective of federal Indian law. It's interesting when you write a journal article, for instance, pointing out that the colonial mindset is contrary and hostile to the Native American mindset, and perhaps there's better ways to teach Native American youth. And then your blind reviewers pick you apart from a colonial position. So they don't even realize they're being colonizers when they do that. I mean, that's what's amazing to me when they tell you that maybe they know more about Native American intelligentsia than you do, and they're not Indian, and you know, they're coming at it from the traditional anthropological or sociological position, and yeah, that's frustrating. We have to fight the battle against the colonial mind every day in Indian intelligentsia, whether we're talking about pedagogy or philosophy or law.
So when you run into these obstacles, what is it you're thinking and how do you maybe prepare yourself? What's your strategy for overcoming these?
Research and publishing, you got to understand that you got to have a thick skin. You're probably going to get rejected, especially early on until you have a name. You're going to get rejected in publishing far more than you get accepted. You got to find a publishing house that you're comfortable with and that will support you. And you got to understand that even if you're in that publishing house, when they send your work out for a blind review, you're going to have people who take their shots at you. And you can't let that bother you. You can't let it divert you from your goal. I refused to make the changes that particular reviewer said, because the mere fact that he made those, or she, whoever it was, made those suggestions merely proved my point. That's all. It just gave me more anecdotal evidence the next time I wrote. And so you got to develop a thick skin. You can't let it bother you. You can't lose sleep over it. And it's hard not to be defensive of your writing because you pour so much of yourself into it. So you got to find a way to do that. You can't take it personally. And the more you get established in academia, if indeed that's where you go with your career, the more you get established in academia in which you're compelled to write for your profession, you're going to find that you accumulate, I wouldn't say enemies, but adversaries, intellectual adversaries out there who seem to be sitting on pins and needles waiting for your next journal article to drop so they can criticize it. So that's some of the things that you have in academia that perhaps you don't have in real life, but you can't let the criticism bother you. As long as you have a publishing house that's happy with you and is putting out without editing out the heart of your work, then you should be happy. And what the reviewers say is what the reviewers say. You're not going to make people happy.
Yeah, I agree with you. I had a similar experience in that early on in my career, I had a case where a person surprised me in being sort of adversarial. I just absolutely didn't expect it. And I went back to a mentor and was talking with her. She's a Cherokee elder. And I remember that her email, because we were emailing at the time, she simply said, "That's enough. You've spent enough time with that. Now get back to work." And I remember thinking, okay, that she's right. I've been upset about it long enough. Now get back to work.
Yeah, it's kind of mourning. Okay, so the stranger on the street tells you that your baby's ugly. So what? You know, that's what it amounts to.
Yeah, it does.
You leave them on the street, you take your ugly baby home. And there you go.
All right. I have one final question for you. And hopefully I kind of brought this up to you earlier. What advice do you have about research in general? And this can be anything from a specific way of researching to general advice. What do you have for us?
Well, maybe two or three pieces. The first is establish a pattern that works well for you. We don't all write the same way. We don't all research the same way. But just take the advice of your mentors and your professors and those people who are experienced and around you. And, you know, if your professor wants you to do it a specific way, do it that way. You got to try on the shoe and see if it fits, but try on the shoe. Do your project the way that professor told you to do it. Take everything that's good out of that method and file it away. And if it doesn't work for you, fine. The next time you do a piece of research with another professor, you assume that professor's method. And you're gaining experience that way, you know, and you really don't know if it's going to fit you until you try it. So make sure that you don't resist any of these methods of research that professors might bring to your attention. They're all very valid. They're telling you this because it works well for them. That being said, as you get more experience, you're gonna grow into your own style. Another bit of advice I would give you is don't play games with deadlines. If you have a deadline for the 1st of December, then my suggestion to you is that you have an internal deadline of the 15th of November. And I tell you that out of experience, because if you let your work schedule in to 1 December, things are going to go wrong and you're going to miss your deadline. Something will happen. So schedule yourself a deadline 2 or 3 weeks prior to the official deadline. And that way you'll find that writing and research and publishing has very little stress involved with it. It's not that big a deal. The deadlines mean nothing to you then, because you're getting the work done 2 or 3 weeks ahead of time. And that gives you then a chance also. And I tell my students this, even if you're just writing a paper in class, if you advance your deadline a few days, that gives you a chance then to put the document down, leave it alone for 4 or 5 days, perhaps, or 2 or 3 days, whatever your timeline allows, and come back to it with fresh eyes. And you'll find that you're going to have a better way of saying this or a better way of saying that. You're going to find ridiculous spelling errors. You're going to find things like that. But you got to look at it with fresh eyes. If you look at it with the same old tired eyes that wrote it, well, you're not going to see those errors. So timelines are important. Find your own method and your own voice while complying. You got to comply with those mentors that you have. Make them happy, because you got to, you know, give a valid try to seeing how that shoe fits. Pick topics as much as you're allowed. Pick topics that you love. And if you pick topics that you love, then research is not a problem for you. Find a question that needs to be answered. And, you know, don't find topics that are just going to be tailored to advance your career. That's a mercenary way of doing it. Our effort in research should be aimed at helping whatever group of people we're concerned with. Like when I write in federal Indian law, I'm looking at the overarching concern I have is tribal sovereignty. Tribal sovereignty to make sure the federal government doesn't whittle away at that further than it already has. To make sure a state doesn't play games with tribal sovereignty for this tribe or the other tribe. And I have that objective in mind. I am writing on behalf of the people. That is my view, on behalf of the tribal people. So that's the thing. Don't write to get rich, because that is never going to happen. Write on a topic that makes sense to you, that provokes passion in you, and write to benefit someone else. I suppose that's it in a nutshell.
Well, thank you for that. That's great advice. And I do appreciate you taking the time this evening to talk with us and to share your information and for being our first person on our podcast, which we appreciate you letting us try and see how it went.
Well, I'm very honored to have been asked, and I'm glad that I am the first person. So it can only get better from here. Look at it that way.
Well, thank you again for your time, and I hope you have a wonderful evening, and we will look forward to hearing from you in the future.
Thank you very much.